Joining us right now is Leo Smith, who is going to teach me something I don't know. And I just love guests who do that. Leo Smith is passionate about reclaiming the night skies. He is chair of the International Dark Sky Association Connecticut chapter. He is a strategic leader working to build momentum for dark sky protection across the United States. He's been doing this for a very long time. He's been awake to this issue much longer than I have. And he's really worked with a lot of communities statewide and now nationwide to try and get some momentum towards reclaiming our night skies, which I think, frankly, right now seems to be going in the wrong direction. I see more and more neon, more and more lit than I ever did before. Leo Smith, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show. Thanks so much for coming on today.
And thank you, Lisa.
So this is a passion of mine. Tell me how and why it became a passion of yours.
Well, we lived on a street where there was a turf farm behind us. And back in the 2001, a developer bought the turf farm and put in very nice houses. But the concern that I had was that I was going to see a lot of glare. And working with the developer, we ended up putting in light fixtures that were shielded. So they put the light onto the driveways and so forth, but they didn't shine the light into neighboring properties. And that's how basically I got started with the International Dark Sky Association.
So, in other words, the technology to do this right by our living creatures exists.
Not only does it exist, but it's a win-win-win all the way around in that the property that's being lit actually looks nicer. It doesn't cost any more. It's not like shielded fixtures cost 20% more than unshielded fixtures. It's just a matter of thinking it through so that when you actually do it, you do it right.
Now, if you do it right for the birds flying above, what about the fact that about 70% of creatures worldwide are nocturnal? So what about our opossums and our raccoons? Do you recommend a lot of motion detectors? Or, in other words, what do we do about that piece?
The motion detectors are ideal. There's also some fixtures that you can put out there that will automatically turn off, let's say, at midnight or 10 o'clock. And the nocturnal animals also include fish, for example. If you have a lighted bridge with light going into the water and you have salmon migration, for example, salmon will stop when they come to that lit area because they feel that their predators will be able to see them. So it actually impedes salmon migration. It goes on and on and on with all of the adverse effects of light pollution. And the wonderful thing about this is that we can do this right, spend any more money.
Yeah, not only not spend any more money, how about all the conserving of money? Do we really need to be wasting? You know what drives me crazy? We're chatting with Leo Smith, International Dark Sky Association. And I'm telling you, it makes my blood boil. My husband can't even sit next to me anymore while we're driving a car. I cannot stand when I go down the post road and I see it's 10 o'clock at night and all these buildings are lit for nothing. And all these parking lots are lit for nothing. It's just so ridiculous. The stores aren't open. There's a building on the Post Road in Norwalk that just went up. That's a moving storage place. And the thing is five stories high, and it's brightly lit 24/7. It drives me crazy.
And I agree with you. It's totally waste. It's just a matter of time before we get to the point where maybe there will be some energy conservation requirements that will dictate that buildings have to be unlit. And you see this in New York City all the time where you have all these floors lit.
Lit.
But the cleaning crew is only going around one floor at a time. Do you really need to have all those floors lit, or could you turn the lights off except for that floor where the cleaning crew is going through?
That's right. And certainly with parking lots, for safety, you could easily have motion detectors by all of these lamps. It would be a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
So that if a person is there or a car is there, you're not impinging upon safety. You're doing the right thing by the public that may stray into a parking lot at night if you're a landlord. But you don't have to keep these bulbs on 24/7.
And even as a next step, if we didn't have a requirement to turn them off, there's technology out there where photocells can be put into these lamps where, let's say at 10 o'clock, if that's the time when the parking lot becomes vacant, and you really wanted to have it on anyhow for whatever reason, perceived security or whatever, there are photocells out there that can reduce the light output by 50% starting at 10 o'clock. So that instead of having this brightly lit place, maybe it would be dimmed down by 50% starting at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, and it makes a very big difference. Let's go to Gloria from Westport, who has a question. You're chatting with Leo Smith of the International Dark Sky Association, the leader of the Connecticut chapter.
Hello, Lisa. Hello, Leo. Good morning.
Good morning, Gloria.
Leo, I have been following this for many, 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 many years, 8, 10 years. Somebody, I heard them talking about this, so I've been doing this for many years. And what I do, and I'm going to seek your help afterwards, I use, the blue painter's tape?
Yes.
I put those on the windows, on all the windows, and I close the blinds at night. So if I have to have any lights open, I immediately, as soon as it's dusk, I close all the blinds. What more can I do?
This is a question of preventing the light from coming in to your room.
It's for the birds, so the birds don't crash in.
Birds.
Yeah, for the birds. Because they do. They crash into our windows. They do.
One consideration would be getting light shielded blinds. There are blinds that you can get from Lowe's or Home Depot or a number of other places that are light blocking so that they actually do block the light either way, from your place going out or from someplace else, like in the morning.
Don't the regular blinds I have do the same thing, and with the curtains in front of it, they should block the light?
No, they're specially manufactured, where if you go to a place like Lowe's, you can find that a certain blind can come what we'll call normal, or it could be slightly light blocking, or it could be complete light blocking, and you can order those accordingly. And when you do put in a light blocking shade, it's very effective in terms of keeping the light out.
More so than normal shades or normal blinds?
Much more normal, yes, much, much more. I would suggest maybe if you want...
It's really expensive trying to place everything around the house.
Going into Lowe's and actually just checking it out, talking to when you go to the blind department, there's someone there, ask them to show you the differences between light blocking and regular.
Okay.
Thank you.
And what about during the day? During the day, there's still light emanating, and I do have I have a lot of bird feeders out there, and in the past, that's why I put the blue painter's tape on the storm window, because we keep that the storm door, we keep that open, and on the windows in the front. I know there is some kind of other product that they sell that emanates some kind of a sound or something or a light, which will deter them. But do you think the painter's tape in pieces all around all the windows is enough for during the day?
During the day, your light from your house is probably not really visible on the outside to any noticeable degree because of the sun.
I see. But they have in the past gone, I've heard them, hit the window or the storm door.
Yeah, they've done it to me twice during my show. Twice during my show, I had birds fly into the window. And I'm really not sure why they're doing that. I don't know.
During the day.
During the day.
A lot of times, it could be that the birds are seeing a reflection off the glass.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That makes sense. Okay. Thank you, Gloria. Leo,
Thank you, Leo.
We're chatting with Leo Smith, International Dark Sky Association, 203-333-9422. One of the things that I've noticed lately is a proliferation of what I perceive to be neon signs. And I spoke with our local planning and zoning chair, and she said they're not technically neon, so that the regulation that prohibits neon a lot of the commercial developers have gotten around it by putting in other lighting, she says LED and other things that are just as bright and give us the perception of that neon. But since they're not technically neon, they found a loophole in the regulations to achieve the same impact with their lighting. And obviously, I guess the answer is a lot of towns need to keep up with lighting in order to rewrite their regulations. Where is the International Dark Sky Association on coming forward with proposed regulations? Do you have any that towns can look at so they don't have to reinvent the wheel that you would recommend?
There are places like Pittsburgh, for example, has developed some very good sign regulations. One of the issues with sign regulations is whether or not signs should be required to be turned off when the business is no longer open. And in a lot of cases, signs are left on all night long, even though hardly anybody might be out there on the road driving by to see
the sign. Absolutely. It's ridiculous.
And that happens a lot with car dealerships, too, where they have all these lights on. They want to show off their cars, which is understandable. But do you really need to show them off at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's the roads are desolate and there's really, you know, like one or two people driving by an hour? I mean, it's crazy. But so there are ways to consider, let's say, if a town was concerned about signing as far as the whether it's neon or anything else, they could adopt a regulation that would say that at 30 minutes after or an hour after the business closes, signs must be extinguished.
And is that what they did in Pittsburgh?
They didn't require that, but they came up with a whole lot of like lighting levels. How bright could that sign be? Sign brightness. There were a number of one of the nation's leading dark sky people, Nancy Clanton from Colorado, was hired by Pittsburgh to come up with their lighting regulations regarding signs.
Why do you think some people care about this more than other people, Leo Smith? What do you think?
I think it's just a matter of awareness. Most people don't think about it. When you drive, do you really think about the fact that when you're driving down the street at night that maybe you don't really need all those street lights?
I think about it all the time, but I'm a different kind of person. I'm obsessed with these things.
And the thing is, what is amazing is probably 85%, maybe 80% of all the streetlights other than the streetlights that are on interstate highways are totally wasted. They're not needed.
They're not.
As a matter of fact, in Connecticut, you know how when you drive down a residential street, you have the typical type of wiring that the utility company puts in with the utility poles holding it up, and then they put a street light on to that pole. Mm-hmm. Well, for 15 years, I was on the roadway lighting committee that sets the standards nationally for roadway lighting. And if you do roadway lighting correctly, you need to place these lights at intervals so that you don't have darkness in the middle. And when you do that, you have to really have dedicated poles, which they do out in the West. They have dedicated poles for streetlights. They don't put them onto the poles that are used for wires. But the utility companies here on the cheap are trying to get by without having to put in those extra poles. So they put them on the utility pole that basically is based on wire weight distribution factors as far as distance from pole to pole. And even then, they skip a pole. They have one pole here, if it has a light, then you don't have one on the next one, then you have the one on the next one. It's crazy. And there's never really been any thought given to the fact that maybe we could have a much better lighting system for roadways if we had a master street light plan adopted by each municipality that would give us the reasons why a street light would be needed at an intersection, in front of a fire department, in front of a school crossing, that type of thing. But if we actually had a street light master plan adopted by the communities, you would end up finding that maybe a significant number of street lights would not qualify and would actually, maybe you could take them down and save a lot of money.
Take them down. Yeah, because you know what? Most of the time, your car headlight does the job. Most of the time when you're driving, it does.
And not,
you don't
not
really
only
need that,
that
street light.
You could, even on highways in Massachusetts, on the Massachusetts Turnpike, there are embedded reflectors, so they don't get popped up when the snowplow comes through. There are embedded reflectors, and you can use 3M makes a paint for streets that's retro-reflective. You can have a wonderful time driving with no lighting at all, except from your headlight, because you use these reflectors in the road, and you use retro-reflective painting for your striping between the lanes. There's all kinds of solutions that would actually give you better driving without having overhead lighting.
Martha Zoller joins us now from WDUN in Georgia. Hey, Martha, how are you?
Hey, Lisa.
How are you driving someplace, sweetheart? Where are you?
Of course. I'm always driving. That's what we do here in Georgia. We drive.
You drive. Well, so, Martha, we haven't chatted, I think, since Raphael Warnock won, since he beat Herschel Walker. I know you're not surprised.
No, I mean, Herschel Walker was out about 4-1. He was a challenging candidate, and Reverend Warnock was able to, you know, turn his vote out for the runoff. Herschel Walker got 57.
Martha, you're not in a good place.
Yes.
You're having trouble. Okay.
Hold on. Is that better?
I think so. I hope so. Yep.
Okay, good. Okay, so Herschel Walker got, Raphael Warnock got about 57% of the early vote, and Herschel Walker needed to get 60% of the day of vote to win, and he only got 58%. So it was close, but,
close.
I think it's fine. I think it's fine.
Yeah, it really was close. So let me ask you about Kristen Sinema, because she startled, the news media, but maybe not her own constituents, when she became an independent. And she claims in her speech that the people always knew that she was an independent, that this is who she always has been, and that this is who Arizona is. Do you know Kristen Sinema? Have you ever met her? Have you ever interviewed her?
I haven't met her, but I think this was a completely political decision if you look at how Arizona's primaries and elections are. Okay, they don't have runoffs, first of all. She was going to be challenged in a Democratic primary from the left, which is ironic because she came out of Code Pink and was pretty progressive, although we found out since she's been a senator that she's, I don't want to say moderate, but she's more reasonable on certain issues, and certainly as it relates to certain issues that Arizona has with immigration and things like that, she is pretty representative, I think, of the people of Arizona. So what's going to happen now is, by her being an independent, then she takes away the ability from somebody to be able to challenge her in a primary from the left. This person may still run that was going to run against her from the left, and I've forgotten his name. But she now all she has to do is get a plurality of the vote in order to win. And her argument's going to be, and we haven't heard it yet, but it's going to be, either you get behind me, Democratic machine, or we're going to elect some crazy person like Carrie Lake if you let this go too far. That's going to be that's her thought process. In a three-person race, she can get a plurality, she believes, and she can fight off a more progressive attack over a longer period of time.
Martha Zoller, when is Kristen Sinema up for re-election? 2 years from now?
I believe it's 2 years from now.
So let me understand this. This is interesting to me. So you're saying, it's sort of like a Joe Lieberman is really what you're saying.
Exactly.
You're saying she's
exactly.
going to, right? That's what Joe did in Connecticut. He lost the nomination then to now Governor Ned Lamont. And he said, okay, I'm going to have to run in my own lane and I'm going to win. And in Connecticut's case, it was the Republicans that threw their support behind Joe Lieberman. You're saying in Arizona, you think it will be ultimately the Democrats who do so?
Yes. I think they're not going to want to run the risk of getting a Carrie Lake kind of candidate in the Senate. And I don't know that Carrie Lake's going to run because she hasn't given up on her governor's race yet. But that type of Trump-backed candidate, because of the four states that had challenges, shall we say, in the 2020 election or were challenged by the Trump folks, all three of the four states, North Carolina, Florida, and Georgia, have gotten, their act together and had great elections in 2022. I think they're still counting votes in Arizona, or else they're still trying to figure out how they're going to audit. I mean, it's a mess out there still. They have done nothing to make things better since 2020, and they have got a very large faction of the Trumpers. It's still not a majority, but they've got a large faction of it.
Yeah, I think the fact that Carrie Lake is still carrying on and refusing to concede, even though judges have basically tried to put her in her place ever since the election. It's just, it's very discouraging to me, just as an American. It's just very discouraging when people refuse to lose. But anyway, so Kristen Sinema, and tell us a little bit, we're chatting with Martha Zoller of WDUN. What, she and Joe Manchin, the two of them, seem to be a bit of a team in stopping some of the very progressive Democratic agenda. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And Joe Manchin's up in 2024 also. And he is in a state that went 65% for Donald Trump in 2020. And also, his Democratic governor has switched to the Republican Party about 2 years ago. So, you know, whether he's going to run for another term or not, he is in his 70s. So, you know, I don't know if he will. But these guys, I mean, it's like a nursing home up there in the Senate. So, you know, they'll stay around forever. But it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, because Manchin is about to get something that was promised to him to get his vote on the Inflation Reduction Act. They're not going to do that. The Democrats aren't going to do it now that they've got 51. And so he's kind of getting a little bit of the shaft based on something he agreed to do. So, and you know what? He has been a reliable Democratic vote. Even though he tries to push them a little less progressive, when it comes right down to it, he votes Democrat.
He does.
I mean, it's not a case that he splits his vote between Republicans and Democrats. He doesn't. Mm-hmm. So he just tries to keep them a little more in the center left lane, and instead of, you know, instead of the far left lane. That's all. And I think that's probably smart. I mean, because really the country's not far left. You know, it might be center right or center left, but it's not far left or far right.
Yeah, that's right. And as far as Kristen Sinema goes, so if she runs as an independent, she's going to allow somebody else to capture the Democratic endorsement. How is she going to find a home for herself running as an independent? I mean, I think it's just a very uphill battle for any candidate to do
that. Well, she's going to caucus with the Democrats, kind of like Bernie Sanders does in Vermont. And she's going to still, you know, caucus with the Democrats. So it is interesting, too, just getting back to Georgia for a minute, is that, you know, if you go back and you listen to the two speeches that were made on election night, and Raphael Warnock's speech was a good speech. He's a very good speaker. But even after he won, he got more votes than anybody. It was a smooth election. We found out on election night. He threw in this line about, just because you have a big turnout doesn't mean there's not still voter suppression, which I think was inappropriate in that moment. Herschel Walker, I was like, people were saying, where was this Herschel Walker? Herschel Walker gave the most gracious concession speech that said, you must support your elected officials. You have to uphold the Constitution. You have to vote. This is not what we wanted, but I'm not going to make excuses, blah, blah, blah. And you're like listening to it and you're going, where was this guy during the whole election cycle? So he gave a very gracious concession speech that really, if you're going to run for office, you ought to listen to it, because it's exactly the kind of tone you ought to take if you lose an election.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Donald Trump was a disruptor in many ways. And one of the ways in which he was, unfortunately, a lasting disruptor was his refusal to concede. And very, very damaging, because it trickled down to so many different people across the country who thought, okay, I can do that too. Look at Carrie Lake.
Well,
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, and I would argue that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who were kind of the worst pair of candidates that we had had in many, many years, you know, Hillary Clinton still, when she does interviews, says that she, you know, the election was stolen from her.
Yeah, that's
that
true.
It wasn't, you know,
right.
Even though she did make a concession speech, I will give her that.
Yeah.
She still, anytime she gets a chance to do an interview, she'll say something like the election was stolen from her. And, you know, we just
it's not true.
I mean,
the truth is that the election was, quote unquote, stolen from her if we didn't have an electoral college in our U.S. Constitution. If she wants to advocate for something, she can advocate to amend the Constitution. God bless. But it wasn't stolen from her. She lost under the current rules.
And really, the 90,000, it was roughly 90,000 Obama voters that voted for Donald Trump in key states.
Right.
And under the Biden-Trump election, about 150,000 people went the other way in those key states. So, yes, it is a system where the biggest states can't have the biggest impact. But I personally, I support the Electoral College for that very reason, because if we didn't have the Electoral College, then all candidates would have to win were the big cities. And I think that it's important because it requires that you campaign across the country by having an Electoral College system. And I think that's positive.
Yeah, I disagree with you, Martha. I think the Electoral College, too often in the last 20 years has not reflected the will of the people. And I don't think we should make an exception for the leader of the country that we don't make an exception for any of our other elected representatives, which is one person, one vote.
Well, and that's perfectly fine. And I respect that. And I know there are good people that are on both sides of that issue. But I personally think that it works well for us and that it doesn't, you know, because we're not a straight democracy. We're not a straight, the majority rules kind of. We do support individual rights. And then I think it's brilliant. But we'll debate that another time.
We can, for sure. Martha Zawith, thank you so much. We always love your insight and your knowledge and your astute commentary. Thank you very much for joining us. Martha Zawith,
WDUN
in Georgia.
And I'll make sure I'm not in my car next time. Thanks.
Okay. All right, sweetie. Okay. Bye. Well, joining us now, rejoining us, because we love chatting with Jennifer Hubbard, is Jennifer Hubbard, who is the mom of Catherine Violet, who is the founder of this extraordinary Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation. And this beautiful sanctuary, which I've had the pleasure of walking through and visiting. She is the organizer of the Senior Paw Project, which we've spoken about before, which takes money to fund veterinarians to go to homebound seniors to take care of their pets. And she just does an enormous amount of good work in our community, and she has stuck around to be in our community. Jennifer Hubbard, it's 10 years ago tomorrow. And how are you getting through these days?
You know, I find myself every year, this time of year, I'm much more attuned to where I was this time X number of years ago, so, you know, 10 years ago. And I can remember the day before Catherine died like it was yesterday. And, you know, each year there's something new or a different aspect of the tragedy of the years that have passed that seem to take a central place in my mind. And while it's such a hard time because there's so much attention and focus given to the anniversary, I also find myself in a place of thinking about and just being in awe of all of the goodness and all of the compassion and kindness that has come into my life over the past 10 years. It really is extraordinary when I stop to think about it, that just how much has changed, but also how much I've been afforded.
So in this year, as we're coming up on the 10th, we're chatting with Jennifer Hubbard, what is occupying your mind this year? What is the newness, reflection, the sharp memory? What are you thinking about?
You know, I'm thinking a lot about the day, well, and probably because it is the day before she died. You know, I especially today, I think about that day. Both of my kids were uber energized about the holidays. Their dad had been overseas for business, and he was coming home. It was a Friday, and so just the energy and the excitement for the holidays and all that was going to come. I mean, we're 10 days out to Christmas. I can feel their energy, and I can. I remember them just being so excited. I had bought Catherine a pair of boots they had fleece inside of them, and they had little bells on the shoelaces. And literally, she jingle-belled all the way down to the bus stop on the morning that she died, just so excited to have these boots with bells on them. And so I've been thinking a lot about the 13th and how I would have said to you then, like, what a perfect life. My kids were excited, and it just was this picture perfect life. But I will also say that, you know, I look at my life now, and albeit with the scar of not having Catherine in it, my life is pretty good. I have really nothing to be angry or upset about. I've been afforded a lot in the past 10 years, probably more than I should have.
Well, that's a pretty extraordinary statement, and probably says everything about you and your soul, and the fact that you can perceive your life as pretty good, is rather, I don't even know what to say to that. So let's talk about why that is, though, Jennifer Hubbard, because it isn't an accident. And
no.
And it's because Mm-mm. of the effort and energy that you have given in tribute and to help others, to help animals, to help other people. Mm-hmm. So tell us about this beautiful foundation that you've started. What does it do?
You know, the sanctuary itself is a place of compassion and of healing. The work that we do really began as a means to honor Catherine's love for all creatures. She adored them all. She wanted them to know, above all else, that she was kind and that around her and with her, that they would be safe. And so the sanctuary was created as a way to honor her, to have her legacy. And I have discovered that in honoring her life and emulating her compassion, I'm seeing extraordinary results in the work that we're doing. So the sanctuary provides programming that honors the human-animal bond. We believe that Catherine's desire for animals to know safety and kindness is rooted in making sure that they live in their rightful habitats. That's how we promote compassion and acceptance. So our work is centered on teaching humans how to care for the animals and the environments that they call home, and making sure that animals stay in their rightful home, specifically with seniors, making sure that they have the resources and support to keep their pets with them. Often, the seniors that we work with, it's their family pet. They've had them for 10 or 12 years. They fall on unforeseen financial circumstances that prohibit them from providing appropriate care for their pets, and we step in. It shouldn't have to be a choice. And so what we've discovered after literally teaching 143,000 people and working with 29 Connecticut communities now, and providing homes for over 700 animals, that compassion in its simplest and truest form can create remarkable results.
Yeah, it certainly can. We're chatting with Jennifer Hubbard, who was Catherine Violet Hubbard's mom. You know, there's been so much conversation about gun violence, and there have been protests and walks and marches and some progress as well, I think. Do you have an opinion or a stance on gun violence? Is that something that you speak out about as well?
You know, I don't. Every single family has found their path to resolve, whatever that might be. Some have chosen advocacy. Some have chosen litigation. Some have said, we're just going to do this privately. I have chosen to focus on compassion and emulating that in the work that we do at the sanctuary. I believe that there clearly is a problem and that there has to be something done to end the systemic violence in our country. There is no reason, in my opinion, that 10 years after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, that we've, from what I've read, we've experienced as a country 3,500 additional mass school shootings. Clearly, there's an issue. But I believe that after each one of these horrific events, we kind of go through the same cycle where everybody's empathetic and heartbroken and want to see something change. And very quickly, the conversation is drawn along party lines and finger pointing and stalemates. And we focus on the divisiveness of the stalling and the inaction of making progress in this area. And so, you know, when I think about this issue of gun violence and responsible gun ownership, I really do think that it starts, all of this change starts with having conversations that are rooted in compassion and a general understanding. I think we have to change the way that we approach the problem in order to change a very complex issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if it were easy, we would have solved it already, right? I mean, if it were easy.
Absolutely. But, yeah. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of people, myself included, you know, are probably like, yeah, compassion. You know, that's a really nice and that's a gentle term. And it's, you know, it's a feel good end of the newscast kind of story. But the reality is that until we start having conversations that seek to understand and seek to come to a mutual place of compromise, we're not going to get anywhere. And my concern is that not getting anywhere or not at least trying a different approach of solving this really, it's complex, this really complex problem is going to keep us going through this cycle. And the more we go through these mass school shootings, the number we become to them. And I don't want to see us become numb to this type of horrific violence.
So we're chatting with Jennifer Hubbard, who lost her beautiful daughter, Catherine Violet, 10 years ago tomorrow. Jennifer, if you had the chance, because I bet that you have had these woulda, coulda, shouldas in your head at night, if you ever had the chance to talk to Nancy Lanza 10 years ago today on December 13th, what would you have said to her? As I'm listening to you and I'm hearing about compassions and conversations, she lived in your town, right? You had everything in common with her, right? So what would you have said to this woman?
How can I help? How can I help?
You know, and what if she had said to you, there's nothing to help about. My son is fine. Then what? What do you do then?
You know, I think that I'm not sure what you do then. I think that we as a community, and not just Newtown, I just think in any community in this country, I think that when we can start looking outside of ourselves, that's why I love the work that we do at the sanctuary, because it level sets. It provides a place where people can understand and see what caring looks like, what responsibility towards other living beings looks like, and they are able to translate what they learn, maybe not knowingly, but I do think that when you can understand a person's perspective or purpose or where they're rooted in, it changes how you look at the world. And what we do at the sanctuary is just that. When we can share that we have a responsibility to this greater, vaster earth, then something clicks in the brain. I mean, it's proven. There have been studies that show that kids that are taught the natural sciences and are taught stewardship are kinder to each other, more caring to the people that they're in this world with. And maybe Nancy would have said to me, there's nothing you can do. But at the same time, maybe if I was more attuned to some of her stressors well before December 13th, maybe I could have been someone that could listen or be there for her. And I think it's always easy to look back and make some judgments. I think what's more important is to look back and say, what could we have done differently mm-hmm. to maybe change the trajectory of this person's life? And maybe that just comes from being present to them well before the actual traumatic event.
Yeah, I'm listening very intently. We're chatting with Jennifer Hubbard. You know, in my other life, I'm a probate judge, and part of my job is to be in the psychiatric hospitals, and I do commitments, and I also come in contact with a lot of children. And lately, coming in contact with children in psychiatric wards, which is a new development, by the way, Jennifer, new development. And I am trying to be less than a cog in a wheel, much more than that, in trying to have an impact where I can to avert things that I already know, I already can see, are the obvious signs and seeds of what could be violent behavior a few years from now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that as a society, even with all the roles that people have to play and so much money that we've thrown at this, in well-meaning money, you know what I mean? Well-meaning.
Of course.
I don't think that, I don't think we have enough sanctuaries. I don't think we have enough obvious places where children who aren't in touch with the natural world and kind people can be placed for a while with caring adults to do that.
Yeah. Lisa, we have always said that if the sanctuary gives a place to a child who doesn't really have a place. I mean, Adam went to a house and, you know, he was confined into a basement where he chose to be. And I don't know. This is a huge claim. And I don't really want to get into the business of making claims, but you know, had he had a place where he could go and know that he was welcomed, that he had a purpose, that his being was celebrated, potentially, could it have averted a Sandy Hook? Possibly. You know, and if the sanctuary can give that place to another individual, just one, and avert a tragedy like Sandy Hook, I'll never measure it. And, you know, I really don't care that I can't.
Right, right. But you're doing more than your part in Catherine's honor and memory mm-hmm. to make the world a better place. And that's already a tremendous amount that you've asked of yourself, a tremendous
amount.
Well,
thank you. I would love to be able to say, yes, absolutely. I have been afforded so much. I have been surrounded by people that are talented and generous and kind and thoughtful and as determined as Catherine was. And, you know, it truly, it's not some crazy cliche. It really does. It does take a village. And I've been privy to that. I really do believe that when you focus on something and by focusing on compassion, my eyes have been open to the compassion that's around me and that's been shared with me.
Jennifer Hubbard, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's a painful time, but you turn it into an important, reflective, good time. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Jennifer Hubbard, the founder of the Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation and the Senior Paw Project, which is right here in our own area in Newtown. You ought to go see it. I've been there. I've walked it. It's beautiful. and you ought to just go there. So thank you very much, Jennifer, as always, for coming on the show. Really.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.